I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 3:16. Members present are Representatives Carrick, Freer, Fields, Hall, Nelson, and Sadler. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phone. Feel free to pass a note through our committee aide, Evan Anderson. Thank you, Andrew Magnuson and Chloe, for committee and teleconference support. We have two items on the agenda. First up is an informational hearing about what is driving increasing costs of healthcare. We have two expert presentations followed by invited speakers who have experienced these steep cost increases. And after that, we'll have a first hearing on House Bill 243 by Representative Carrick on barbers, hairdressers, and aesthetic licensing. First up in the informational hearing is Jared Kosin, CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. Mr. Kosin, thank you for being here and giving this presentation.
All right. Thank you. Can you guys hear me okay? All right. For the record, my name is Jared Kosin. I am the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. And today I'm going to talk about the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits. And in doing this, I'm going to really talk about the impact on costs and the pressure that it ultimately puts on the healthcare system. So my comments will be brief. Happy to answer questions throughout or at any point as you see fit. And so to start, I would like to just really set the context for what this is, because honestly, it gets pretty confusing. The first thing to start with are advanced premium tax credits. Okay, advanced premium tax credits are essentially the subsidy that was created for people who are in poverty, according to the federal poverty level, that need to buy insurance coverage on the Affordable Care Act exchange. The advanced premium tax credits were set up to create a subsidy so basically people can afford it depending on your poverty status. In 2021 and 2022, those credits were enhanced, or they were increased. And that's what we're really talking about today, is those enhancements expired on December 31st due to inaction from Congress. Now, I do want to recognize, I think it's really important to acknowledge, Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski both voted to extend the enhancements, and we appreciate that. They both obviously understand the issue and the importance, but due to, you know, the majority of votes, the credits did not get extended. And so looking at this, these enhancements dropped off. And so the question is, like, what are we left with? What is the impact? And I know you're going to hear from the Division of Insurance today. They did a fantastic white paper last year back in March that they presented to Senate Finance. And I know they're going to update the numbers for you today. And that information shows us that around 27,000 or 28,000, depending on which set of information you're looking at, Alaskans basically get some type of subsidy to buy their coverage. Okay, so that's the population we're dealing with. If you look at the enhancements, those increased credits, compared to the original credits, we're talking about $43 million. And so stated a different way, when those enhancements expired just a couple weeks ago, Alaska lost $43 million in subsidy support.
Sure.
No. I can pause to further check.
How about the chair. Representative Sadler, why don't we go to the end of the presentation and then do questions, okay?
Okay, sure. I'd better to pause, so I thought maybe you wanted more questions. So, and I do have some, so.
Thank you. So when you talk about $43 million, obviously we're used to talking about budgets and things like that. When you look at it at the consumer level, what that translates to is those 28,000 people who use these subsidies in one way, shape, or form. It's a sliding scale. For a lot of those people, we're talking about a doubling and tripling of insurance premiums. And so I think we all know already insurance is really expensive. Imagine your premiums doubling and tripling in cost. That's what we're talking about. When you have a doubling or tripling of insurance premiums, you basically, people are being put in the position, regardless of how they got there, of whether or not they can afford it. What we know will happen, and this just happened, so it's not like we can see the consequences, you know, from a systematic standpoint just yet. But we know people are going to be forced into a decision of, okay, we either pay for this coverage or we forego coverage. Our primary concern at the Hospital and Healthcare Association from a system standpoint are those that are put in the position of foregoing coverage. The reason we're concerned about it is when someone foregoes coverage, this isn't just affecting them individually. Of course it is. But it's actually affecting all of us. All right? When people do not have coverage, they still need health care, and they ultimately will get health care. But the cost of providing that care is completely uncompensated. And when uncompensated care goes up, essentially providers, regardless if we're talking about hospitals, regardless if we're talking about primary care, they're put in a position of doing one of two things or a combination of both. They either have to shift those costs onto someone who can compensate them or pay for them. In this situation, we're talking about if uncompensated care has gone up, I can't shift that on to Medicaid and Medicare. Really, I just shift it on to private insurance. So basically, everyone else, if all of us are on private insurance, we're going to ultimately pay more to cover those folks that are uncompensated. The other option the providers are faced with is cutting services. And you see that in service providers that offer kind of a diverse set of services. They have to let some things go because they just can't absorb all those costs. Both of those things are, in our opinion, are bad outcomes. And so if we take this a level deeper and we talk about this situation where people are foregoing care, really what this turns into from our perspective, again, at the Hospital and Healthcare Association is you have some people that are just going to say, okay, I'm going to forego coverage. I'm not going to get healthcare. Okay, that might work for a while, but inevitably people get sick. The problem with that is eventually you will get too sick to stay away. And by the time you need services, you're going straight to the emergency department. And the unfortunate situation there is by the time you come to us to see us, you're a lot sicker than you would have been before. We're the most expensive environment of care in the entire healthcare system. And now we're going to have to dedicate more resources to you because you're in a sicker, more frail state. That's not a good outcome for you, not a good outcome for providers. The second thing that will happen and does happen every day is you need health care. You don't want to wait until you're going to get too sick. So you're going to go get health care. Well, you're probably not going to find anyone to take you. And so you're going to go to the one place that will. And that, again, is the hospital emergency room. We have a duty and a lawful requirement to see everybody that comes through the door. And we will do so. The problem with that is, let's think about what's going on right now. I don't know if any of you have been to an emergency room lately. It's on record. I know the state epidemiologist talked about this. You read about it everywhere. This is a horrible flu season right now. We have higher volumes of flu, and it's much more severe than it's been in past years. And so if you're deciding that, hey, I need healthcare, I'm going to go to the emergency room, again, we're in the situation of where we have to divert precious resources, even if this is for a little cut on your finger, time and staff have to be dedicated to you away from others that need you. And so in really wrapping up, the concerns we have just on a policy standpoint is we're talking about tens of thousands of people that are going to be in this position. How many will choose to forego? How many will choose to use the emergency room in this fashion? It hasn't played out yet, but the potential is absolutely there. And we don't really have room right now to deal with that. I brought this up. I met with a group of our nurse leaders from around the state last week. And we talked about this issue. And the first thing someone said is they groaned and said, oh, great, we're going to have people coming here to use us as a primary care provider. And they were truly exhausted because they're just getting crushed by serving people with the flu. And so what I would leave with before I, you know, open up for questions is the cost of healthcare is too high. You know, we're the first to acknowledge that. We have high labor costs. We have increasing supply costs. We have extreme worker shortages. The idea of seeing people not have coverage, the idea that that will somehow save money, in our opinion, is a falsehood. When you want to bend the cost of healthcare, you actually want to increase access to care. And I can understand how that sounds like, well, that seems to contradict itself. The more access you provide people, the more efficient they can access the system. Namely, we can have people go to the primary care providers, urgent care, much cheaper, and we can catch things before they become more severe and drive up all the costs of our healthcare system. So in closing, you can hear we're extremely concerned about these premium tax credits expiring. We're very grateful to Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski both for supporting and extending these. But these are really very real consequences when you're talking about $43 million in lost subsidy support and a doubling and tripling of healthcare premiums for thousands of Alaskans. So I'll stop there and happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Kosin. Representative Klum and actually Representative Gray, who's in the audience, got here at 3:20. And I might suggest we have Representative Sadler, Representative Carrick, and then we do have four small business owners online. So why don't we do these questions and hear from the Division of Insurance and maybe hear from the small business owners just to respect their time. And then if Mr. Kosin and Ms. Carpenter can stick around and take more questions, that would be wonderful. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kosin, for being here. You know, the topic of our meeting is the rising cost of health care, but most of all of your presentation was on the rising cost of health care insurance. And so a question is, so we had the Affordable Care Act was created to make health care affordable, but apparently it was not sufficient, so we had to have enhanced subsidies. We had subsidies, and we have enhanced subsidies. So what I really don't hear any discussion about how we can reduce the cost of health care. You're talking about the cost of health care insurance. And yes, there is interplay between people seeking care or not seeking care because of the cost of insurance. But I think mostly we're talking about the high cost of health care insurance. Is that a fair question or a fair statement?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's a really good question. Because it's interesting when you talk about health care and really, you're right, I just talked about insurance. In our system, the two are so interrelated that one drives the other. And so what I would say to you, these subsidies, it wasn't about the Affordable Care Act being created and then, well, that's not enough. We have to enhance them. This was largely driven during the pandemic. And then when inflation increased, I think those were the decisions that drove the idea of enhancing them. But I would answer, to me, to drive down the cost of care, so to get at the root of all of this, it's really providing ready, efficient access to services. And the only way of doing that is in our healthcare system, the way it's set up, is to increase coverage. Right. And so what I am saying is the two are interrelated. And essentially, we need people to have coverage so they feel free and clear to go to the doctor at the appropriate level rather than not having coverage and trying to make decisions maybe based on financial consequences or other and neglecting their care. So I don't know if that answers your question, but hopefully it does.
Yeah, I guess follow-up and a question. So I guess I really don't see an end to the process. If healthcare is expensive, then healthcare insurance, we need to enhance it more, and you save more health insurance for everybody's way to bring it. I can't see an end to this process until everyone's got free healthcare insurance as a way to address the high cost of, you know, healthcare. But and that's probably a more philosophical thing. What actually can we do to address the high cost of healthcare itself? You know, we have insurance mandates. We say we should provide coverage for this and for that, and people demand a state-of-the-art services. I mean, that's independent of the insurance cost. But what can we do to actually reduce the cost of healthcare other than subsidize insurance for it?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, just to kind of answer the philosophical thought. I'm not saying that the answer is free healthcare for everybody, and I don't know if you're saying that, but what I'm saying is, yeah, you really, this is a type of situation where you essentially have to invest up front, and it takes years to pay back. And I just don't think the investment has made in a way that's been given time to pay itself back. So for me, in Alaska, we have a lot of services that don't exist. We have complex behavioral health services that don't exist. We have primary care that is hard to access. If you can cure those access points and create post-acute environments where people can discharge to, I actually think if we had more healthcare infrastructure and corresponding workers, because we have a severe worker shortage, so you can't just build everything. So you need an investment there. You need investment in infrastructure. This is a multifaceted issue that can't be answered with, well, let's just subsidize insurance and call it a day. This is a piece, an important piece, but it's not the only piece. And I could talk for hours on this. I assume the committee does not want me to do that at this time, but certainly would be happy to talk more at your discretion.
Well, why don't we go, Representative Sadler, why don't we return to this? I just want to make sure we get to the small business owners. So let's go to Representative Carrick, and then we can come back to Mr. Cosin after the business owners, okay?
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Cosin, thank you so much for being here today and for walking through it like I'm in elementary school. I think it's really helpful. I felt like you spoke right to me because I just had a constituent pass away who did not have coverage and had to forego coverage from the flu. So your example is extremely real, especially in this particular flu season, apparently. I just wanted to ask you, of the 27 to 28,000 Alaskans who you mentioned have had this, with the subsidy end, have had to either make ends meet some other way to afford coverage or foregoing coverage, do we know approximately how many Alaskans fall into each of those buckets, or is that very hard to ascertain?
No, through the chair, Representative Carrick, thank you. Great question. I think it is broken out. The Division of Insurance will be able to comment. Just to add more color to your point and your story, and I'm not making this up for the record, certainly can't, right? This is on the record. But I just left a meeting with someone. They were asking me what I was doing here and what I was testifying on, and they immediately chimed in and said, oh, my daughter is married and has one child, so a family of three, and she just lost her subsidy. So she fell in the bucket of the enhancements where originally she was getting $0 in the subsidy under the original advanced premium tax credits, but over the last couple of years, the enhancements have been subsidizing quite a bit of her insurance, and now starting this year, their premiums truly have tripled, and you'll see that in the Division of Insurance's materials. This is very real stuff, and it's sad in the consequences. So to answer your question very directly, I think the Division of Insurance has it broken out by tier and how much they expect, so they could probably provide more information for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cosin, for sticking around to answer more questions after the other testifiers. And thanks, Ms. Carpenter, for being here. And you can stay right there if you want.
Oh, totally up to you. I'll go back here. You guys can call me back out.
All right.
Thank you, committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Fields and Co-Chair Hall. For the record, my name is Heather Carpenter. I am the Director of the Division of Insurance, and I was asked to come to provide a refresh of a presentation the Division provided last spring on our 1332 waiver and just an overview on the tax credits and the situation we're seeing. When we talk about health coverage in Alaska, we like to start with grounding you on what the division is regulating and covering. The division is a smaller piece of the pie, where that yellow sliver you see, that's 15% of the market, with 85% being all other payers. So that means when you're looking at insurance bills and Title 21 statute, that's impacting the individual market, the small group, and the large group. So moving to slide 3, I wanted to ground you into some information about the individual market. For those who may not know, when we talk about the individual market, Alaska is on the federally facilitated exchange that is run by CMS. Some states have state-based exchanges, we do not. So our initial enrollment for calendar year 2026 that was released from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid does not include consumers who have paid their first month's premium or the effectuation of the policy. We'll get that information, we hope, in the next few months. In the next slide, we'll have these numbers for you. Overall, our rates decreased on average for this calendar year. A really important note is the Alaska Reinsurance Program, or ARP, has lowered our rates by 40%, and it does continue to bring some stability to our market. However, as you heard Mr. Kozin share, many consumers are now paying more because Congress did not extend the enhanced premium tax credits, or EPTCs, and this has created some uncertainty. So moving to slide four, you can see here, this is information that was just recently released from CMS. We had 25,493 individuals who signed up during open enrollment for this calendar year coverage. Again, that does not include how many have actually paid that first month's premium. To compare last year, so for 2025, those who actually paid that premium and effectuated their coverage were 26,732, and that equaled a rate of 93% for an effectuated rate. Moving to slide five, and I apologize, when I was looking at these this morning, I realized I should have put this in a different order. For those of you that have been tracking the rates of insurance over the years, this chart will look familiar to you. So in 2014, that was the first year of the Affordable Care Act in action and with new rates on the individual market. And then you see different rate increases through over the years. So this chart is showing rates for Premera and Moda, who are two insurers in the individual market now. A couple of things I want to point out on this. You saw some high increases in 2015 and 16 that led to legislative action about our waiver that I'm going to get into in the next few slides. 2017 was the first year of the Alaska Reinsurance Program with state funding. And then 2018 was the first year we had federal pass-through funding that had a decrease. And while there is a slight decrease in rates in 2026, that does come after three recent years of rate increases, which are now being felt more after the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits. So moving to slide six, I'm going to dive into the reinsurance program and just give a brief history of how it was created. So the Affordable Care Act allows for states to apply for what we call a Section 1332 State Innovation Waiver. You may remember that under former Director Wing Heyer, she had proposed that the division apply for one of these waivers to fund a state-based reinsurance program that would help stabilize the market. In 2016, the legislature passed House Bill 374, which enabled the division to actually apply for the waiver with the federal government. And we apply through the United States Department of Health and Human Services, through CMS, and the United States Department of Treasury. And again, we call this our Alaska Reinsurance Program, or ARP. And that first year, the legislature funded $55 million of an appropriation conditioned on the division further seeking the waiver in federal funding. Moving to slide seven, the ARP is a condition-based reinsurance program. That means that there are 35 high-risk and high-cost conditions that if somebody has one of those conditions, their costs are ceded to the program. So a practical example, someone could be on the list who has hepatitis C, and if they get an ear infection and need to go to urgent care, all of the claims for that and any claims related to their hep C treatment is not paid by the insurer, so Premera or Moda, it's actually ceded to the Alaska Reinsurance Program. And that helps bring stability because it takes out those high costs for those individuals from the market. The ACA provides individual market consumers with subsidies. Those are called advanced premium tax credits, and they are based on their income. And then the 1332 waiver application proposed that the government would fund a reinsurance program by awarding the difference between the original tax credits and our lower tax credits, thanks to our waiver, which is called pass-through to the state. So moving on to slide eight, The Division of Insurance was awarded our waiver in 2017, and we were the first state-based reinsurance waiver in the nation. Our waiver was extended for an additional 5 years at the end of calendar year 2022. And I'm proud to say through calendar year 2025, the waiver has brought in over $800 million back to Alaska in the reinsurance program. And again, that is lowering the individual market rates by 40% annually. Our current waiver expires at the end of calendar year 2027, and the division will start preparations to apply to extend the waiver at the end of this calendar year. Moving to slide 9, I wanted to show you a little bit of how this funding works and how the federal government figures out what these savings would look like. So each year, the division submits rates with and without the waiver to CMS and to the Treasury. So they take that and come up with a calculation that you see on this chart that projects what those advanced premium tax credits would cost the federal government without the waiver and what it would cost the federal government with the waiver. Then they come up with what that projected savings is, and the division ends up being awarded a portion of those savings as our pass-through funding. Moving on to slide 9, this is another chart that may look familiar to those who have tracked the reinsurance program over the years. The second column here is the original projection by our contract actuaries, Oliver Wyman. This was in our original waiver to CMS on how much we thought we would need each year for the waiver. Calendar year 2026 is the last year they projected, so we'll remove that column starting next year. The third column is the actual program amount set by the division. What that means is that's the amount that insurers can submit for reimbursement to the program. And if they have claims that exceed that amount, they do not get reimbursed above that amount. Every year, our insurers, so Primera and Moda, have exceeded the program amount in claims, again, with those 35 high-risk conditions. The next column is the federal pass-through funding awarded by Treasury. I will note you start to see from 21, 22, and 23 some pretty large awards that the state was given that far exceeded the program amount. I wish I could say that was going to continue, but that was a little bit of a fluke in the CMS and U.S. Treasury formula that benefited the states. They have since rectified that formula, and we are no longer seeing program or funding, pass-through funding, that's going to exceed our program amount. And I will note the state contributions, only that first year in 2017 was general funds. The other years have been from our ceded premium account, which I'm going to talk about in the next few slides, and those excess pass-through funding. The last thing of note for this, the division actually has to set our program amount before we know what our pass-through funding will be. And part of that is because our insurers have to start submitting their rates in June of each year. And we go through negotiations with them, and CMS reviews those rates as well. And our rates go on a calendar year. I will not know our 2026 federal funding until March, April, May. It's always a little unknown when CMS and the Treasury will tell us that. All right, moving on to slide 11, our ceded premium account. So insurers who are participating in the market are required to cede consumer premiums and pharmacy rebates, any federal high-risk cost pool payments they get with individuals that have those 35 conditions. They cede that money to the Alaska Reinsurance Program, and it is held by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, or ACHIA. And ACHIA uses the ceded premium funds to pay for administrative expenses. That way it does not hit the division's budget. We aren't requiring extra general funds or anything like that. It was the source of the state portion in 2018. And the legislature also appropriated $10 million. It was two $5 million appropriations of the ceded premium funds to the division that we passed along to the Department of Health in 24 and 25. And that was used for Medicaid programs, including the Medicaid rate study that you may be familiar with. For calendar year 26 and 27, again, like I said on the last chart, we anticipate that federal award pass-through funding will not equal our program amount. That being said, we plan to use ceded premium to make up that difference. And our current estimates are that $85 million for the 2 years will be needed, which we do have in the account. Moving to slide 12 is about advanced premium tax credits. Mr. Kozin gave you a fairly good overview of how that works. And the Affordable Care Act does require that a contribution to premium from consumers be based on their household income and size, or that federal poverty level. The amount that they get is a very technical formula, and it's between the second lowest cost silver plan and the consumer's contribution amount, and that's the subsidy. As Mr. Kozin said, during the pandemic in 2021, the American Rescue Plan increased that contribution and put in place what they called the Enhanced Premium Tax Credits. Those tax credits were extended through another piece of federal law, the Inflation Reduction Act, but those expired December 31st, 2025. And then moving on to slide 13, the division has been asked numerous times over the last year to provide specific examples of what a consumer will pay with the expiration of the tax credits. And this slide and the next slide give examples based on the updated 2026 rates. And I will just point out, we provided you, you know, three different federal poverty levels to give you an example, and we included 401% as one of those points because that is the point. Anything over 400%, there is no longer any tax credits that a consumer qualifies for. So this example here is a single adult. And then on slide 14, we provided some examples for a family of four. And Mr. Chairman, I also provided to the committee a white paper we updated that provides lots of information that we've been asked, just technical questions. How does this work? It also answers Rep. Carrick's question on who falls into the buckets by federal poverty level. We provided you an example of what's the actual income based on federal poverty levels. So there's a lot of information that may answer just basic questions about how all this works. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Let's go to the testimony of small business owners and then return to questions. Mr. Yes, Chairman. Representative Sadler.
I think there's a lot of technical information went by here. I fear that after the presentation by the small business people, the time to ask questions about this presentation will no longer be ripe. Is it possible to ask Ms. Carpenter some questions now?
Let's just take a couple minutes, but I do want to respect just the business owners' time who are waiting.
Absolutely.
Go for it, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. So through the chair, Ms. Carpenter, a lot of technical insurance money going back and forth and back and forth. So help me understand in general terms, is the Alaska Reinsurance Program Alaska accepting money from the federal government to help pay for insurance or help provide benefits to Alaskans? Not quite, you know, a lot of technical terms, but what's the money flow here? I did see $155 million general fund expense, but I'm not sure where the rest of this money is coming from.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, you are correct. So just like it is with the Medicaid program and when they apply for a waiver to do something innovative, that is exactly what happened here. The division on behalf of Alaskans applied to the federal government to basically pull down federal money to help add money back and reduce rates for our Alaskans on the individual market. Mm-hmm. So the reason the feds are willing to do that is because it does save them money. You know, in essence, they're not going to give us all of the savings they receive by us having this program, but a portion of those savings.
Thank you. And finally, I did see that the cumulative between 2017 and 2025, $803 million. About how much is that per year? I don't know if there's an average per year kind of thing. This is on slide 8, your third bullet point.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I moved the presentation back to slide 10 because that fourth column has each year what that federal pass-through award has been.
Under federal pass-through, so pass-through being federal funding come to the state, so between about $60 to $120 million a year. Correct?
Correct.
Okay, very good. Okay. And if the follow-up again, if the administrative costs for the APR were coming from the ceded premiums, and it looks like that ceded premium money may be needed elsewhere. What's the source of funds for the ARP administrative expenses going forward?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, and again, this is Heather Carpenter for the record, that if the ceded premium is used for another purpose, that would bring a question back to the division, to the legislature, to our department on how would we fund this program.
General
because,
fund.
Yeah, there would need to be, right now, the division, our budget is through receipt services on when people have a license through us, that's how we fund ours. So the administrative expenses aren't a lot, but again, it's that now we're going to have to start paying that higher state contribution, and that's what will be different moving forward.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. There's many more questions, but wanted to respect everyone's time, including the committee members. Please proceed.
And thanks for sticking around, Ms. Carpenter. At this time, let's go to Shayla Teague with ARC Insurance Solutions to talk about your experience with rising health insurance costs.
Hello, I'm Shayla Teague, a licensed health insurance broker here in Alaska. I worked primarily in the individual and family market since 2019. At one point, I assisted with approximately 10% of the Alaska's marketplace enrollments, and I currently sit on a committee with CMS providing feedback on how the marketplace functions in Alaska. I'm here today to share what the expiration of the enhanced tax credits means in real practical terms for Alaskans. When the enhanced tax credits were in place, many of my conversations began with surprise. Small business owners and self-employed individuals often assumed health insurance was simply unaffordable for them. I worked with many people who had gone years without coverage and were relieved to finally have access to affordable health insurance. I also frequently worked with individuals who had been harmed by the subsidy cliff, that 400%, in the past. Typically, these are self-employed Alaskans with unpredictable income who estimate to the best of their ability, only to later find out they exceeded the threshold and owed tens of thousands of dollars back to the IRS. The enhanced tax credits and the elimination of the cliff provided something incredibly important, and that's peace of mind. They made coverage affordable, reduced the number of uninsured Alaskans, and stabilized enrollment for households with variable incomes. This most recent marketplace open enrollment was the most difficult of my career. Many clients were in shock and some were even in tears. Enrollment conversations that typically take about 30 minutes often require 2 or 3 one-hour appointments. Many clients delayed making a final decision until the last possible moment, hoping the enhanced tax credits would be extended or that another solution would be announced. They simply could not believe that they were being asked to pay double or even triple what they had paid in prior years. I also saw significant confusion among consumers due to widespread headlines about tax credits expiring. Many people believed that all financial assistance was ending, which led some to disengage completely from the enrollment process, even when they did still qualify for some level of support. This confusion and premium shock were not isolated, and one example illustrates what many Alaskans are now facing. I work with a married couple in their late 50s with an annual household income of approximately $115,000. Now, in Alaska, that is a solid middle-class income, but it's not exceedingly high. Yet, because it broaches the 400% of the federal poverty level for a household of two, that's $105,720, they lose their eligibility for the tax credits. Their monthly premium will increase from $600 in 2025 to approximately $3,300 in 2026. This is also not like a platinum insurance plan. It's numbers for the least expensive plan available to them, which is a bronze. And it still carries a $10,000 annual maximum out-of-pocket per each of them. That represents a 450% increase to their monthly premium alone, and their situation is not unique. I saw this time and time again this year. Due to unaffordable premiums, many individuals will now go uninsured. In fact, we saw about an 11% decrease to marketplace enrollments this year, and this directly increases uncompensated care and places additional strain on hospitals and urgent care facilities across the state. Prior to the enhanced premium tax credits, I still did work with a significant number of higher income Alaskans who paid the full cost of their health insurance, but at that time, monthly premiums were far more attainable for those households. For example, a couple in their 50s might have paid around $1,500 per month for coverage. However, over the last 5 years, premiums have continued to increase year after year, and today those same households are facing costs that are no longer affordable at any income level without assistance. Thank you for the opportunity to share what I'm seeing firsthand and for considering how these changes are affecting Alaskans.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mrs. Teague?
Yes.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you to the Chair, Ms. Teague. Sorry I didn't know who you were until I have him help me. So you're in the business, Ms. You're kind of an insurance expert broker. Have you any solution? We've heard a couple of folks, and I suspect we're going to hear some more explain the dire situation they face in dealing with the high cost of health insurance and health care. Have you any solutions? Do you think where do you think we should be heading to come up with a solution to these problems? Any ideas?
I don't have any solid solutions. I think that extending the tax credits would have bought us some time to find those solutions. But I do think it's a good place to look in expanding availability for health insurance in the small business area. If more small employers are able to affordably offer health insurance to their employees, there may be less of a need for these tax credits on the marketplace.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, not seeing further questions at this time. Thank you, Ms. Teague, for providing your testimony today. Next up is Laura Butcher with CNL Creative. Ms. Butcher, thanks for being here.
Hi, my name is Laura Oates Butcher. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify. I truly appreciate being able to share how losing the healthcare subsidies has impacted my family. I'm a small business owner. My husband and I have owned CNL Creative, a marketing and video production company, for the last 10 years. My husband is a third generation Alaskan. His family has lived in the West Side Spinard area of Anchorage since the 1940s. I've lived here for the last 25 years. We have two teenage children, and we love calling Alaska home, and we take great pride in being active members of our community. Last year, we were paying $1,400 a month to insure all four of us. This year, our rates jumped to $4,250. That is $51,000 a year just for the premiums. While the price going up threefold was indeed shocking, that was half the story. If we opted for the cheapest bronze plan, the cost still would have been more than $39,000 a year, and the deductible, it all of a sudden now increased to $15,000. That's $56,000 out of pocket before insurance would make any kind of meaningful contribution to our healthcare costs. When we did the math, we simply couldn't make it work. We are currently uninsured. It's an awful feeling, and it's one that we don't take lightly. We aren't ignorant to the fact that you can't prepare for the worst. In fact, last year we had a medical emergency. We were beyond grateful for the insurance that supported us, so we landed in the emergency room twice. We were then referred to see a much-needed specialist Alaska did not have, so we ended up at Seattle Swedish Hospital. We then had numerous follow-up care visits with amazing providers right here in Anchorage. That medical emergency surely would have bankrupted us had we not had insurance. We know it can happen again. In fact, a necessary follow-up visit with tests that lasted an hour just 2 weeks ago with that same provider in Anchorage without insurance, it cost us $1,000. My daughter, my teenage daughter, had an annual well-child checkup visit. That cost us several hundred dollars. This was routine, preventative, no issues going into the visit, no new issues being diagnosed. While the cost of out-of-pocket care in Alaska has been astounding, we still wouldn't be close to that $15,000 deductible, even if we could afford the insurance premiums on any of the plans. I ask you, how many Alaskans do you know that can easily afford almost $38,000 to $51,000 a year to pay their premium and still must pay out of pocket beyond that because of a high deductible? What is our other choice? At our age, I'm 51, my husband is 54, health sharing programs that you see advertised, they're especially in Alaska, really expensive at our age. They're also difficult to be accepted into and extremely difficult to find providers and hospitals that will work with the program because they technically aren't even considered insurance. We have contacted and shared our story with Alaska's congressional delegation on multiple times. Today, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to share our story and our testimony with this committee and all of you today. We are hardworking and we love Alaska, but for the first time ever, we truly have started considering living out of state, where the cost of health care is more affordable, in places where even without subsidies, we could probably manage easier and have much better health outcomes. We appreciate the opportunity to share our story with state leaders like this committee. We know positive change can happen, and we're not going to give up hope. Small business in Alaska is at the heart of so many communities across the state. We invest our time, our money, and our skills to make a difference. Healthcare costs are now making it almost impossible for people like us to call Alaska home. Thank you so much for listening to my testimony today.
Thanks, Ms. Butcher. Are there questions for Ms. Butcher? Yeah, Ms. Butcher, when we met with Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski last year, we urged them to include extension of enhanced premium tax credits in the budget reconciliation bill, H.R. 1, because that was the only opportunity to get the extension of that program past a filibuster. Of course, that did not happen, hence lack of extension, and I'm sorry about the impact to your family.
Thank you for the recommendation.
Next up in testimony is Mark Robikoff, owner of AK Bark. Mr. Robikoff, thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon. My sincerest thanks to this committee and its chair for allowing me this opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Mark Robikoff, and I am a small business owner in Anchorage. I submit my testimony today, not in reference to any specific bill before the legislature, but as a desperate plea to my local representatives to help in any way they can. My financial situation has been turned on its head. Small businesses like mine are often referred to by two anatomical metaphors. They are called the lifeblood of the community and the backbone of the economy, in reference to their critical importance to the body of the city, state, and nation. Our citizens and politicians are universally supportive of Alaska's small businesses in their public pronouncements. All seem to want more of them, not fewer. No Alaska politician was ever elected on a platform of wanting more and stronger behemoth conglomerates that funnel our dollars to the lower 48. My store is called AK Bark and offers retail pet supplies. Our slogan is intensely Alaskan. Not only is it locally owned, but we also feature and promote products from over 30 local suppliers who are also Alaska small businesses. We buy from national and international suppliers only when quality, locally made options are not available. Our most profitable category is pet treats and exclusively features products from Anchorage, Matsu, and the Kenai Peninsula. There are already many barriers to starting a small business. When I started mine 10 years ago, I invested my life savings and worked 6 days a week without pay for over a year. All this while knowing that half small businesses don't last 5 years, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Prior to the COVID shutdown in 2020, my earnings from my new store were low enough to allow me to purchase health insurance through the Affordable Care Act at a reasonable rate. As my store gained traction and my earnings went up, the ACA subsidies kept my premiums manageable, though they were still 2 to 3 times those of my friends and counterparts in the lower 48. I accepted this as one cost of living in such a beautiful and rugged state. My wife is employed by another Anchorage small business and does not enjoy subsidized health care from them. Been buying health care coverage for us both through the ACA since its inception. Our combined monthly health insurance premium in 2025 was $953. On January 1st, our new premium more than tripled to $2,886. A nearly $2,000 monthly increase for the same level of coverage. In 2025, my little store seemed to hit its stride. Revenue was up around 25% from the previous year. It was time to consider expanding. Residents of the Matsu Valley, Fairbanks and Kenai Peninsula begged us to open stores in their communities. It seemed the natural next move to grow my business and expand our Alaska footprint. All of those plans have now been shelved. The funds that would have been invested in expansion are now needed to pay my family's insurance premiums. This increase literally targets small business owners. The expiration of the subsidy hits us no differently than a tax increase that is narrowly applied to us. Imagine a bill that levies a huge new tax specifically on small businesses. Who would support such a bill? It would be broadly rejected, and any politician supporting it would be shunned and voted out. My accountant, my wife's employer, and most of those 30-plus local suppliers all find themselves in the same catastrophic predicament. Some of those suppliers are among the many local businesses that have decided or been forced to shut down. I'm sure that most anyone who is considering starting a local small business has similarly shelved those plans. They cannot afford to consider leaving a job that provides health insurance assistance that is otherwise unavailable. This bombshell of a change has already and will continue to change the very makeup of our communities. More small businesses will founder and fail to the benefit of outside mega corporations. More and more of our residents' earnings will flow beyond Alaska's borders. Some of those small business owners will instead choose to drop their coverage to stay in business. As I understand it, as coverage is dropped, more primary care is handled by urgent care, and more health care goes uncompensated, driving up the cost of all health care, not just insurance premiums, for all Alaskans. My family's health is too important for me to consider dropping our insurance coverage. I plead with our Alaska representatives, including members of this committee, who have ever paid lip service to the lifeblood and backbone of the economic body, to now find ways to help the tens of thousands of its members in similarly dire straits. Our lives and well-being have been severely impacted, and we need your help, not in word but deed. Thank you again for your time and attention. I wish you all the health and security that I wish for my family, my state, and my community. I'm happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
Thanks, Mr. Robocoff. There are a couple of questions. Representative Colomb and Representative Sadler.
Mr. Robocoff, is that right? Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to clarify, you're pleading with your state legislators. I'm just trying to clarify, what exactly do you want us to do to fix this situation?
As I mentioned, I'm not addressing any specific proposal or bill before the legislature. I have just run out of options, and I'm pleading with any representative that I may reach to understand the situation I'm in, how it affects the economies of my local community and of the state, and to search in any way that they can for some assistance to help undo this mistake.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Representative Colomb asked my question. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robocoff.
Thank you for being here and sharing your experience, Mr. Robocoff. Next up is Janice Fleischman. Thank you, Ms. Fleischman, for being here.
Thank you for having this meeting. I think Laura, Shayla, and Mark have done an amazing job of talking about how this has impacted small business. We've lost a lot of well-trained bakers over the years. So I'm Janice Fleischman. I own Fire Island Rustic Bake Shop. We're in a little bit of a different situation. So what I started saying is we've lost a lot of bakers that we trained because they moved to private, bigger places in order to have health insurance, which we couldn't provide. We decided this year, based on the fact that the premiums, the enhanced premiums, were being eliminated, that many of our staff would no longer have the ability to have coverage. We were also impacted by the state ballot measure one, which says that in order to use your sick leave, you have to provide a doctor's note after 3 days. Urgent care centers, because almost none of my employees, I have 75 employees, have a primary physician who's out of their reach. So they have to go to an urgent care to get a note to justify that they were using their sick leave. Well, that's not fair. That's $200 to be able to utilize a ballot measure one sick leave. So we moved to insure this year. We started our insurance with Premera on January 1st. The rate that we were required to, the maximum we could require is something, is a bit based on a calculation, and it was $280 or $3,200 a year per employee. Many of our young employees who we urged in the past to be on the exchange, and they were on the exchange, made a decision not to carry our coverage because of that cost, which to Shayla's point shows you how tight their budgets are because of the cost of housing and everything else. So we ended up insuring 18 of our eligible employees. A number of employees dropped down below the employer level of 32 hours so that they could still be on the exchange. So we have a current cost to the business of $13,500 a month to insure, and it is a very good policy, and that's $162,000 a year on a small business. As you probably know, Fire Island has been successful and has been a big contributor to the community. However, we have no idea how we're going to afford this, and we're wondering how that will impact the cost of the baked goods in our shop. It's a tremendous cost, and it doesn't even accomplish what I hope, which would be to encourage everyone that works at Fire Island to have coverage. We love our employees, and if someone has a catastrophic accident or illness, we'll probably end up reaching into our own pocket to help, but that will not be adequate because the cost of anything catastrophic quickly becomes hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I appreciate this meeting. I didn't really know I would be giving testimony. I thought it was a bigger crowd and I would be mostly listening. I'm ready for questions if there's anyone that has any questions for me.
Well, thank you for sharing, Ms. Fleischman. Are there further questions for any of the panelists or for Mr. Cosen and Ms. Carpenter? Sure, go ahead, Representative Care.
Thank you, through the chair. I think my question is for Heather Carpenter.
And you all are both welcome to just come back.
Give in the keys.
Yes.
And while you're getting situated, the question I think is on slide 5 of the presentation. Just looking at the 2025 difference in Premera and Moda to 2026. And I believe this question was answered by our small business owners that testified. But you had said the, earlier in the presentation, you had mentioned that the costs, the rates decreased on average in 2026, but that isn't made up for because of the end of the tax credit. And is that what we're seeing on this chart on slide 5, or are we seeing something else here? And then I have a follow-up question.
For the record, this is Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance, through the Chair, Representative Carrick. I wanted to make sure folks understood, you know, what they were seeing about the rates. So I think your interpretation is fair. I was very pleased and worked very hard with the insurers to have, you know, on average a reduction. So that average reduction was a negative 2.2% for the rates this year. But okay. That was after, 3 years of 19, you know, an average of about a 15% rate increase each year. And in those years that those rate increases happened, the enhanced premium tax credits were there. So consumers are paying more of their premiums than they were pre-COVID. And it's just the numbers mm-hmm. and facts.
And then just a brief follow-up through the chair. Is it fair to say that even with those rate decreases, the premiums would still be relatively unaffordable to small businesses purchasing on the open market? And then the failure to extend the enhanced credits makes that even more unaffordable? Or were we approaching a place where some of the small businesses that testified today could have potentially covered these costs? It sounds like they were insuring themselves and that those rates decreasing was helping. I'm just trying to get a sense of how dramatically, aside from the individual examples we've heard across the board, we've seen rates increase with the failure to extend the credits and the fact that the rate decreases, while good, didn't insulate from that effect.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, and again, this is Heather Carpenter for the record, that's going to depend on a number of factors. So it's going to depend if these small businesses were getting their insurance on the individual exchange, which is where the tax credits and the enhanced premium tax credits exist. The one testifier talked about covering their employees, and that would have been on the small group market, where there's not tax credits to insulate that. And then it will depend on what is their income. You know, some small businesses, their income's still going to be under that 400%, and they're going to qualify for advanced premium tax credits. So it's all going to be based on each individual scenario. And I don't want to give a broad stroke of saying everybody's the same, because it truly is. What is their income, and what insurance are they getting?
Thank you. And thank you to the small businesses that testified today, too.
Okay, next up, Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. So, Ms. Carpenter, I was just looking on your website, and it says that the Division of Insurance fulfills our mission statement by protecting consumers, promoting competitive insurance market, and ensuring the financial stability of our insurance. I don't think any of those things are happening. I mean, you're the gatekeeper for us, for the state. You're working with insurance companies. It says consumer protection. I guess I would like you to let me know what are the efforts to keep the rates down, consumers to be protected. For like, this is an outrageous situation, and we all know it. And the more the government gets involved, the higher it goes, and the bigger the mess. And the businesses are just a tip of the iceberg. I took my elderly mom to primary care for an emergency. She had private insurance and Medicare, and they wouldn't take her. Like, it's outrageous. And so I see state departments, you're the gatekeeper. You're the one that can fight for us. Every single insurance policy that I have has skyrocketed. Home insurance, medical insurance, all of it. Life insurance, car insurance, everybody's policies are going up. Everybody's premiums are going up. The medical costs are outrageous. I mean, I appreciate the people testifying today, but this is not anything I didn't know. I hear this from my own constituents. So I'm trying to figure out, what is the Division of Insurance doing to mitigate all these, and why do you keep approving all these rate increases for your people?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, and again, this is Heather Carpenter for the record. Thank you for sharing that. And your frustration is noted and shared by many. I will say, when we're looking at health insurance, it's incredibly fragmented. Mm-hmm. And my first slide that showed the different percentage of the market is a good example of that. The Division of Insurance has 15% of the market. So when we're looking at rates, we're looking at those rates for the individual market, the small group, and the large group. Mm-hmm. We have to review when the insurance companies submit rates. We have to check that they're following all of the rules set by the federal government, mm-hmm. and the Affordable Care Act, including those enhanced benefits and including, you know, anything that's what we call an essential health benefit. It has to have all of those. We also review to make sure the rates they're proposing are actuarially sound. If they're proposing, and why at one point in my chart I showed you that Moda left the market, it's because financially they were not okay. The rates that they came in were too low. And the reason the division went after the 1332 waiver is we were on the verge of losing Premera from the market, because insurers are businesses. Mm-hmm. So they're not out to make a lot of money. I will say the division
I have to disagree.
Well,
with
I will
that.
Say in Alaska, let me share the consumer protections. Former Director Wing Heyer, and this has continued with when I was looking at rates this year, we don't allow a large contingency of profit in the rates that they file with us for health insurance. Mm-hmm. It's very, very low, like 1-3%. The things we're also looking at is to make sure their financials are sound, because what is worse of high premiums is you have an insurer who files and says, I don't need to pay X, Y, and Z, and then they go bankrupt because they're not getting enough premiums to actually pay out the claims that are there. We don't have a backstop like the state of Alaska, for example, and our insurance of state employees that is peppered throughout the state budget. So we don't have employers, you know, fronting that, where the state employees, our contributions went up, but much less than what the state is funding mm-hmm. on our behalf. Our market is paid up by people paying insurance out of their own pocket, and our market is feeling that. I will note, Mr. Kozin shared earlier, we see cost shifting. That is also a part of what we're dealing with. And so when our federal payers are too low, Medicare, and you described how hard it is to get mm-hmm. Medicare access in this state, when those payers are too low and providers don't accept it because they can't break even, then we have a problem. Or if they do accept those federal payers, then they're cost shifting that to private insurance, which is our market, or self-insured. So it's incredibly complicated. The state is looking at this. We're looking at the Rural Healthcare Transformation Program. What can we do? The division is reviewing proposals to look at primary care. How can we shore that up across payers? Unfortunately, there is no simple answer and no easy button, but mm-hmm. the division has to look at, when a rate package comes in, is it justifiable? Are the rates, you know, set for many factors? We have to make sure they're not excessive, but that it is accurate. And we use contract actuaries to help us review all of that math as well.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
Yeah, so who benefits from these tax credits? Who financially benefits from that?
Who,
and the subsidies?
Again, Heather Carpenter for the record, through the chair, Rep. Colomb. Who benefits? I would say it's probably two-part. It's the individuals who are on the individual market who qualify for the tax credits, so their premiums are less each month.
But someone gets that money. Who gets the money?
Then it's going to come to the insurers. So the federal government is going to, you know, contribute a little that to the insurers.
Yeah, the insurance
on the
companies.
Behalf.
And the premiums go to the insurance companies. And I understand the balance, but, you know, it's a hard sell for me that they're just barely making a profit in Alaska. I really have a tough time with that. And we're about to just be an uninsured state. We can't afford this. I mean, regular people can't afford it. Poor people can't afford it. Low-income, high-income business, it's untenable. And to me, you know, you just, like, the insurance companies are the ones that are benefiting. And whether it's medical insurance or my home insurance just went up 80%. Why? Because the state approved the rate increase. So you guys, my understanding is that you have to approve these premiums for all insurance rate. And if your mission is consumer protection, I wish that there would be some different angle. And if there, please tell me if there's statutes that need to be changed, I'll carry them. Because something is, I mean, we're all worried about people leaving the state. Yeah, there's school issues. But if you can't afford health insurance, you're out of here. I mean, we can't just be an uninsured state. So I appreciate all the work that you guys do, but I'm super frustrated. It's a year after year this has been going on. And every year, you can give me all the tables you want. I'm telling you, everybody's getting priced out of the market. Everybody. It doesn't even matter what situation you are. It's just like for my mom to have Medicare and private insurance, they won't accept because she's on Medicare, but they don't accept Medicare. I mean, it's like there is no, in my opinion, no landing spot where you can say, for sure, I'll be covered if I do this. It's not there. And the business owners, I thought, were really good at articulating that. but it's not just business owners, it's everyone. So thank you for the latitude. I appreciate that.
Go ahead, Mr. Cousin.
For the record, my name is Jared Cousin. I do not work for the Division of Insurance. I just want to make sure I clear that up. But I do want to just add one thing, because I agree with everything you just said, Representative Coulombe. And I kind of want to go back to what Representative Sadler was asking earlier, because so much it feels like everyone's finger-pointing. Well, I don't know. They're doing it, or it's their fault. You know, one thing I would point out, in Ms. Butcher's example, is a case in point where she talked about her daughter needing a wellness exam. Thankfully, she opted for it, but she had to pay hundreds of dollars. If you look at the cost structure in our Medicaid program, if you look at it in Medicare and you look at private insurance, I'm not going to get the statistic exact here, but there's the 80-20, 70-30, 90-10. It's one of those ratios. Let's just take 80-20. 20% of the population is driving 80% of the cost. So why aren't we focusing on those 20%? And why are they driving all the costs? Because they have chronic conditions and comorbidities. Why? Because their care has not been managed well enough from the beginning. So if Ms. Butcher did not take her daughter to her wellness exam, and God forbid, you know, things got missed or you're not keeping up on that, we're just perpetuating this problem. And, you know, Ms. Carpenter, well, I agree with, by the way, for the record, on insurance and the insurers, and I don't really get the math either, but she is right about Medicare, you know, and she's right about Medicaid. You know, our budget's been flat funded for years, and I'm not asking for more money, but the point I'm making is if you have 20% or 10% of the population driving all the costs, there's got to be better use of care management and service provisions to prevent this explosion in costs.
Representative Sadler had a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You know, I appreciate the passion and the frustration expressed by my colleague from South Anchorage. There's a tremendous amount of unfocused anger, if not despair and frustration, we've heard from the officials, the bureaucrats, and from the people who are insured and insurance recipients. It is frustrating. And again, I'll go back to a point I made earlier through Mr. Cosen. I do keep hearing about how health insurance is very expensive, and healthcare has become shorthand for health insurance and healthcare. And I guess we're only peripherally talking about the cost of health care itself, not insurance, mind you, although there is an interplay. You know, why is health care so expensive? And you just touched on it, Mr. Cosen. That's the sickest among us. The end-of-life care is driving that. And the health insurance cost is a downstream effect of that because it gets subsumed into the entire pool. So I was going to ask the question as well, Representative Coleman, how much is the insurance industry committing to the high cost of health insurance? Because, you know, they're not trying to, you know. But and I'll continue over on slide 5 of Ms. Carpenter's presentation entitled Alaska Individual Market Rate History. You know, this is not a measurement of health care costs, but it's an indirect reflection through the health insurance premiums. Looking back, 32% increase, 39% increase, 7% increase, 22% down, 6% down. But then there's a lot of big increases and not a lot of decreases. I guess my question to Ms. Carpenter would be, first, why those huge increases? Are there more claims? Are there more expensive services? Is it bigger insurance profits? And then looking toward a solution, what allowed us to receive the decreases? How's that for a question?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, again, for the record, this is Heather Carpenter. You pose a great question. And the rates, again, are, we look at them every year when they're filed with us, and we comb through, you know, the factors that play into it. Unfortunately, we have a fairly sick population, and that plays into it. If you have a sicker risk pool and you have higher costs, higher claims, you're going to see higher rates. So several of these years, that's what we saw. It wasn't only the pandemic, though that was, you know, part of it. Also, after 22, 23, 24, you had folks who delayed care during the 2020 and 2021. Then that pent-up care you started to see when they then used care, and we had claims that exceeded what we thought. So again, we look at it every single year. When the companies file those rates with us, We comb through. We send rounds of questions to the companies to ensure that what they're sending us is accurate and actuarially justifiable. Again, the rates can't be excessive. One factor, you know, that the division tried to help reduce this cost and reduce the continuing increases was the repeal of the 80th percentile regulation, which did have some downward pressure on the rates. So it's a number of factors. We're doing what we can to look at it, but this is complicated. The ACA did not make it less complicated. It made it more complicated. A really wonderful thing of the ACA is pre-existing conditions are covered. That's probably the most popular thing about the ACA. But that being said, that means you're insuring folks with some high costs, some high conditions, and that adds to increased healthcare costs. So it's, again, it's managing sick care, and it's just complicated. Health policy is not simple. So we are definitely trying to look for solutions. And again, I will pivot a little bit to the Rural Healthcare Transformation Program, where we're hoping that will help us transform the system across payers and hopefully invest and see some gains down the road.
Just briefly spin. I do hope we can turn our focus to ways we can reduce the cost of the care itself and not just subsidize, put band-aids on, and pour money into insurance companies. So,
yes, that's the goal, Representative.
Can I have one more question?
Sure.
Thank you, Chair. So does the state of Alaska tax insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Colom, again, this is Heather Carpenter. Yes, the state of insurance does have an insurance premium tax on all insurance companies and the policies they file.
But, I mean, but it's the policies that we pay for. There's an additional tax to that, correct?
Through the chair, yes, that has been in the insurance code for many, many years. So by and large, for almost every insurance product, it's 2.7%. There's some factors that change that, but that is the standard.
So it's my understanding we get about $80 million in revenue from that tax. Do you have any idea how much of that is the health insurance policy?
Through the chair, I don't off the top of my head, but I can follow up with that information.
Yeah, because right now it doesn't feel like this is a really good place to tax people. So maybe we need to look at that. If we're taking $80 million in taxes, and maybe it was there to help fund the division or, you know, to process whatever, but I'm not sure that this is the area that the state should be making more expensive. It's not helping. I'm not saying it's the root of the problem, but I'm just saying it's not. This is not something that is assisting Alaskans get health care. So, but if you could give me the percentage that's health care, I would appreciate that.
And through the chair, Rep. Colom, just for the record, the division is not funded at all with the insurance premium tax. We pass that along to the Department of Revenue and the Treasury, and it is appropriated by you all on other sources. So it's in the revenue source book every year on what we bring in. One place that is kind of line itemed is the tax we get on workers' comp insurance gets handed over to the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor.
Okay.
But we are not funded as the division on any of the tax money.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, following up that question, so if there is a 2.7% tax which insurance companies pay on their premiums, that becomes part of their base rate, and who, and you know, don't taxes kind of tumble downstairs to the actual premium payers for us to pay? That may be one factor in the high cost of health insurance. Is that a fair assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I mean, like all taxes, it's got to be paid by someone. So how those are then put into the policies and the rates. But again, I will say, you know, for the high cost of healthcare and this tax, it's only on those under the purview of the Division of Insurance. So it's not the other 85% of the market of healthcare.
Okay. Thanks to everyone, the small business owners and Ms. Carpenter and Mr. Cosin for being here today. And by the way, Representative Bynum has been here since about 3:55. So thank you, Representative Bynum, for participating. Next up is a first hearing on House Bill 243 by Representative Carrick on barbers, hairdressers, and aesthetics licensing. Go ahead and begin your testimony. And did you want us to begin with Mr. McKinley?
I think we
just briefly introduce it?
And briefly introduce the bill. Okay. And then we'll go to the chair of the board.
Great. Good afternoon. And for the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks, bringing you today House Bill 243 by request of the chair of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, who is invited testimony in just a couple of moments. House Bill 243, very simply, codifies an existing practice with the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers and the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development's CBPL division. So right now, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers has 7 members that are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. They serve for 4-year terms, and as with any of our other boards and commissions, these are volunteer positions. Currently, the board has 1 licensed barber, 2 licensed hairdressers or esthetician license, a licensed body pierce or tattoo artist, a licensed manicurist, and 1 person licensed in something else regulated by the board, as well as a non-licensed member of the public. So these are folks working in professions, often small business owners themselves, who are also volunteering to be on the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. The purpose of House Bill 243 is to essentially just prevent the possibility for licensure backlogs or bottlenecking in our state, ensuring that businesses can continue to provide services without being hindered. It is currently standard practice for the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers to delegate their licensing authority to CBPL, and this legislation just codifies that existing practice as being allowable. Further, in our sectional, we just add language that conforms to existing practice right now. I'm sure it was just an oversight at one time when the statute was originally being composed, which just clarifies that the board in Section 2, in addition to being able to approve licenses or permits, can also refuse licenses or permits. They can currently do this. We double-checked that, but this just adds that into statute as well, so it's clear that this is within their purview. That is the entirety of the bill, and for a little bit more background why we're introducing the legislation, I'd turn it over to Kevin McKinley, who is one of my constituents and also the chair of the board.
Thanks for being here, Mr. McKinley. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kevin McKinley. I am the chair of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. And I'm also a business owner. I own a tattoo and body piercing company that has 4 locations, 1 in Fairbanks, 1 in Palmer, and 2 in Anchorage. And I've been open for 35 years now. A while back ago, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers reviewed applications. And at some point in time, they decided to there needed to be a more efficient way of doing this. The Department of Law suggested that we create a checklist and put that into our regulations so that the division could use that to review and approve applications. Recently, the Department of Law came to us and said, you were given bad information. What you need to do is one of 2 things: either review these applications yourself, or there needs to be a statute change. The board unanimously voted to have a statute change, and we feel that this will be one of the most efficient ways of processing applications, and if this does not pass, the backlog will be very substantial. The license applications for 2025, we did 971 applications. That would be very difficult for a board of 7 that are volunteers to approve. So as Representative Carrick says, what we're looking to do is codify what we have been doing and keep this process being as smooth as possible, that way that we're not delaying anybody from going to work or hiring people to work. So I encourage all of you to vote for this bill. Thank you, and I'll keep my testimony short, and if anybody has any questions.
Questions for Mr. McKinley or the bill sponsor, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. McKinley, I'm not sure if you're an attorney. You might have asked an attorney and gotten the answer. Has the understand the desire here is to sanction or kind of sanctify existing practice. Does the practice heretofore create any cloud on the license of those who have been issued their licenses before the statute might take effect?
Through the chair, Mr. Sadler, I'm not sure that I understood your question.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just saying, so you're trying to make sure that things are all done according to Hoyle. Have things not been done according to Hoyle so far? Raise any questions about the validity of the licensing actions taken so far?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that may be a question for Division Director Rob Silva or Sylvan Rob.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Director Sylvan Rob is here. Thank you for being here to help answer this question. So Ms. Rob, just to restate, has anyone on the board sort of put themselves at risk by engaging in this practice up to this point? And if so, do we need to think about that? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Sadler. I don't think that any of our current licensees are in jeopardy. This is just, since this has come to light, it felt like it was important to not continue once it had been brought to our attention, but we certainly don't see any jeopardy for any of our nearly 7,000 current licensees. So we don't want them to worry.
Thank you, sure. I wanted to make sure and get that on the record so no one got nervous.
That's great. Representative Clem.
I'm not sure if this is for the sponsor or you. I guess I'll just throw it out here, anybody who wants to ask that. So my understanding is that the licensing would go through the department instead of the board.
Through the chair to Representative Clem, it still preserves the ability for the board to do licensing functions. This just codifies that the board is within its right, I suppose, to defer that responsibility to CBPL.
Okay.
And that is currently one of the things that the board has done to manage those 7,000 licenses.
So if we can I do a follow up. So
sure.
if the department's doing the licensing, should the board be disbanded?
Through the chair to Representative Clem, I'm glad you asked that question. I would say no, emphatically, and a large part of that is because the board does a lot more than just issue licenses. They're also the board that regulates all esthetician professions in Alaska. I think they serve an incredibly important purpose, and having those business owner seats or those licensed professional seats on the board is really important to navigating the profession in general. A lot of people think the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers just covers hairdressing, mm-hmm. which has its own complications and challenges and potentially risky procedures, but it also covers tattoo artists, as you heard from Board Chair Kevin McKinley, who owns a tattoo shop, and it also covers manicuring and podiatry and other professions.
Okay, great, thanks.
All right, further questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. McKinley or the division director? I'm not seeing any. We will return to this bill, so let us know if you have amendments. Let the bill sponsor know. We will next meet Wednesday, the 26th, first hearing from Department of Labor and Workforce Development on workforce issues, and next turning to the first finance subcommittee meeting around 4:15. It is 4:45, and Labor and Commerce is adjourned.